is abundant, sufficient for the luxury and convenience of the people in Jeff, I think.
Jeffries Show.
And welcome to the Donald Jeffries Show. I'm Donald Jeffries. My special guest today is Joan Mellon. Joan is a best-selling author of 24 books. That's just incredible in and of itself, including A Farewell to Justice, which is, I think, the best overall look at Jim Garrison, in my view. She's written about the U.S. Liberty. She's written about Marilyn Monroe. She's written about feminism. Her work has appeared in the New York Times, Los Angeles Times, Philadelphia Inquirer, all over the place. She's a professor of English and creative writing at Temple University in Philadelphia. Just a fantastic resume, and I'm honored and thrilled to have her on the show. Joan, welcome to the show.
Thank you very much, Donald.
Well, it's great to talk with you. So I know we have a lot to talk about because you've covered so many subjects, but I think we'll probably talk mostly about the Kennedy assassination and Jim Garrison in particular. So you got started, I guess, down this road. Did you volunteer for Jim Garrison? Did you actually work with Jim Garrison during his investigation, didn't you?
Well, no, I didn't. What happened was that my husband at the time, Ralph Schoenman,
yes,
he had sent Jim Garrison the articles from the Italian newspaper by Paese Sera, which discussed the various CIA operations, and the name Clay Shaw appeared. And this was a very unusual because there it was. It had never been made public before, and it was in this Italian a newspaper, I suppose, not a left paper, but sort of an independent newspaper. And so my husband got the articles, and he was living in London at the time, and he got the articles and he sent them to Jim Garrison. Now, if you recall, I don't know why you would, but the Shaw trial, it was this was not mentioned. Shaw's having been exposed as part of CIA's outlying project was not, Jim Garrison did not use it in the trial at all. And I think one of the things, he was very scrupulous, although that's not what he's known for, but he was very scrupulous, and you don't use newspapers as research sources. It was not considered credible. So he never mentioned it. And yet, so that was in March, the trial was over, and in May, Garrison invited us to come down and meet him. We had never met him. Ralph had never met him. So we went down to New Orleans, and that's when I met Jim Garrison.
Wow.
And we spent a week, and he was just so unusual a person. He walked down the street, and people would say, "Hello, Mr. Garrison." And I didn't understand why that was, particularly black people. And I couldn't figure out, I didn't even know that he was district attorney of Orleans Parish at the time. Why would I? He never mentioned it. And so I didn't know anything. He never mentioned the trial. He only wanted to talk about evidence and facts about what was known about the Kennedy conspiracy.
Well, had you read some of the critical books already? Did you already have an interest in the subject before you met Garrison?
Yes, I had. Because I knew Mark Lane. Mm-hmm. And Mark Lane had rented a church in New York to discuss the oddity, shall we say, of the government's version of what happened in the assassination. Mm-hmm. And everybody was spellbound by that. And he wasn't paid to do it. And he just did it. And people came there. And so that's how I knew Mark Lane. So he was all, but it turned out Mark Lane had written his book, A Rush to Judgment, in my husband's apartment in London. He had nowhere to, needed a quiet place to work. And he wrote that book in Ralph's apartment. So Ralph knew him much better than I did. Mm-hmm. I don't think I knew him, actually, beyond his public persona until I was with Ralph. And Mark Lane always had these dogs, And two, I remember the first time that I met Mark Laney, he had these big collies that bit. And the collies are usually very gentle and nice, and these were biters. And he had a series, he always had some dogs that were not the usual thing. I remember more recently when I was working on A Farewell to Justice, and I went to Mark's house in London, not in London, in Washington, D.C., and there was a dog there. He had a dog called Giselle, and she really hated everyone, but somehow she was in my heart. I don't know why, but she was very friendly to me. So that made a big impression after all the years. But Mark wanted to talk about himself and his own work, which is formidable. Mm-hmm. And I was only interested in Garrison. So we had a little thing. But Mark played an enormous role in challenging the official version of the Kennedy assassination.
Absolutely. Go ahead, I'm sorry.
No, I mean, the people in the so-called research community, they would never like. And they never gave him any credit for anything. And I should have known it when I saw that. Yeah. I mean, it's not personal. You may not like someone or whatever, but Mark was he did the major work on the subject.
No, he was the most visible figure. He was the only one that got really on TV early on ever, and he was because he had a very outgoing personality. He had kind of a flamboyant style, and I think I told you this before that I. As a teenager, when I first started getting interested in the JFK assassination in the mid to late 70s, I joined Mark Lane's Citizens Committee of Inquiry. So I got to work alongside him when they were trying to, and, you know, he was my hero. I mean, it was like working with your idol. And, you know, just he is still, my political beliefs were formed basically with his originally, because I was a civil libertarian like him. There are not too many civil libertarians left, but I really admired that about him, and you know, obviously, I looked up to him quite a great deal. So, yeah, I still hear people, but that same research community that we see it today, Joan, and that's the problem, isn't it? That back then you were in the center of it. Then when Lane and Weisberg, my other hero, who I got to meet once as well, but they hated each mm-hmm. other so much, and they were so jealous. And well, Weisberg.
Oh, that was really. I have to blame that on Weisberg, not on Lane, because yeah. Weisberg hated anyone
yes,
who knew information about the assassination that didn't come from him. Yeah. He was insane. He really was really absolutely insane. But he opened his basement where the files were
yes, yeah.
in his house in Frederick to Posner.
Yes. Yep.
Gerald Posner. And he went down and he let Posner go down to the basement there by himself without being watched.
Yeah.
Because he flattered Weisberg.
Yeah, Weisberg didn't have a kid, so I guess, you know, he took Howard Rothman's place, I guess, as a, you know, as a kind of an honorary son or something.
I'm sorry, I don't understand that.
No, as far as it, maybe you said Posner flattered him, so I think maybe Harold looked at him as a son or something. I don't think he had kids. So maybe, maybe it was something like that, but yeah, he certainly betrayed him by taking it, and then his last book that Harold wrote was Case Open, which was a response to Case Closed.
Right, but it didn't make any difference because Harold was the worst writer on earth.
Yeah.
And even one of the principals in the Kennedy assassination, now I can't remember which one, says, I can't remember the one of the people that Harold interviewed, and that he gave him a book or two. And this guy said, I can't read this. And it was a criminal. It was like one of the people in the assassination.
Yeah.
And Harold was, he just couldn't write in the English language. And then he got mad at me because I stupidly said, oh, well, I'll try to help you get this whatever it was that published. And of course, I couldn't.
Yeah.
Nobody would publish that. But that had nothing to do with the value of the material.
No,
basically, if came and told Harold, you found out something, and I found out a lot about the Kennedy assassination in terms of the summer of 1963 and what happened in East Feliciana Parish. Well, he had not done that research himself, so it was worthless to him.
Well, Weisberg's Oswald in New Orleans is a very valuable band. Weisberg, ironically, did a lot of work there. that Garrison benefited from, but then he turned on Garrison, you know, big time. And he turned on everybody, but he definitely turned on Garrison.
Well, you see, Garrison had a court case in Washington, D.C., trying to get the autopsy photographs for the Shaw trial. This was just as the trial was about to start. And somehow Weisberg got into the courtroom and came up to the judge, and the judge said, "Mr. Weisberg, sit down." And they didn't call him as a witness. Garrison did not call him as a witness. Garrison wasn't there, mind you. It was Numa Bertel, one of his assistants. But he won the case, you know. And then so the judge looks at the prosecution. I guess it's the defense. He looked at the other side and said, "What do you want to do?" In other words, do you want to appeal? And they did, because they wanted to continue it so that Garrison wouldn't get the benefit of the photographs, whatever it was worth or not worth, we won't go into now. But so Weisberg was thrown out of the courtroom, and I guess he never forgave that. Among other, I don't know, there may be other things too that happened. Yeah. But Carroll, it was hopeless to deal with him.
Yeah, he was a grumpy old man, definitely, no question about it.
But anyway, so between Harold and then all the rest, Di Eugenio, who, you know, idealizing Kennedy like that, it's an embarrassment. How can you possibly present any of this as worthy of serious attention? That's what I say.
Anyway. Well, because the community today, the research, of course, you had all these big names, but they generally fought with each other. But, you know, obviously a lot of great work was, because we're still relying on, I mean, people, you know, people don't understand that these 26 volumes of hearings and exhibits were prohibitively priced so that very few people could afford them. And it was like Lane and Weisberg and people like that paid the $80, which is a lot of money in those days. You had to buy the whole set and went through them. And they did the work that investigative journalists are supposed to and didn't do. So we wouldn't know about a lot of this stuff if they hadn't done that work. It's a shame they feuded with each other. But here we are almost 60 years later, and the community mentioned Jim DiEugenio. There's so many of people out there, and I don't know what they've never, you know, liked my work, apparently. But I really don't know it, what they're trying to prove at this point. There's a movement out there to discredit Fletcher Prouty now. Obviously, Jim Garrison, we're going to talk about the new book that you were talking about, that we'll get into that in a little bit. But what is your opinion? Is there anybody out there today doing research whose work you admire?
No.
That's the way. Tell it like it is.
Well, I don't know. Nothing new has come out that we can trust. The work on Patrice Lumumba in Congo, the best work was done by the government of Belgium. They wrote the real report, not the church committee that took up the issue. So I don't know what to say. I don't read any of that stuff anymore. I don't. I did the best I could, and I'd hoped that I worked so hard and spent so many years and gave out so much information that I wouldn't have to, that it would be inconceivable that somebody could write a book like this new book that's come out that says that Garrison prosecuted Clay Shaw Kennedy assassination.
You're referring to Cruising for Conspirators, How a New Orleans DA Prosecuted the Kennedy Assassination as a Sex Crime by Alicia Pilon. So go ahead.
It's out to be teaching at LSU, I think. And it's inconceivable, I disproved it in a million ways, but I don't want to get into the battling in the mud with people because they're not honest. Everyone who I thought knew that Garrison never even mentioned the sexual life of Clay Shaw at the trial. It didn't even come up, and that Garrison forbade any of his people or assistants or people who to even mention it.
Right.
So the idea that suddenly there's a sex crime, it's a d- dishonest from the title onward.
Yeah, it's
and
ridiculous.
I don't understand what is the motive for trying still this day and age to discredit Garrison.
Yeah, well, I think, you know, we talked a little bit before the show. I think this is a part of the ongoing effort the media has where they continue to try to push this Oswald did it impossible narrative, which was destroyed, you know, as far back as Rush to Judgment, Mark Lane, and Accessories After the Fact, Sylvia Moore, and the work of Weisberg. I mean, they completely showed, if they showed one thing, they may not have proved, I never say I know who killed Kennedy, because I don't. But I know it wasn't Lee Harvey Oswald, so I think we need to start from there, that they lied to us, and then you can figure, okay, why are they lying to us? But Garrison, certainly you saw the way, and I know you have a different opinion on Oliver Stone, but certainly his film, when it came out, was attacked viciously by most of the media.
The students, I had a course on the Kennedy assassination at Temple University, mm-hmm. and when my students saw I showed JFK, Oliver Stone's, and they just, their mouths hung open. They were so shocked that it just was an eye-opener for them. It changed their lives.
Yep.
So, and I'm sure that whole generation. So now my problems with Oliver Stone are different. Right. He allowed personal things to get into his work in this field. And very disappointing and very distressing and very, I don't know. Anyway.
Well, but certainly you're on the same page with him as far as Jim Garrison, because, I mean, if anything, he might have idealized Garrison a little bit too much, because he wanted to, and I understand what he did. And I think that's why Weisberg got so pissed off and leaked the advance copy to George Lardner, of all people, the Washington Post, which was despicable to do that. But
right.
I think he was jealous, because I think he and maybe some others thought they should be the hero, because Stone had to pick a hero for dramatic effect. He picked Garrison, and he did kind of put everything into that one character. But I think it was largely pretty accurate, don't you?
Well, I think that he had to. You know, how do you show Garrison was the only public figure who right. ever took this up, who ever took up the Kennedy assassination. So why shouldn't Garrison be the main character in that? It's about his struggle to make this information known. I don't understand how Oliver Stone could have done otherwise. I personally don't like the romanticizing and sentimentalizing and, you know, the part about his marriage and all of that. I thought
right,
that was,
right.
you know, embarrassing. But as far as the case is concerned, well, I don't know. Stone yeah. and Weisberg have in common that they can't stand anyone that discusses some aspect of it that they don't know or that they didn't do the research on.
that could be almost everybody involved in this with researching this. Because it attracts, you know, Joan, that this subject really attracts some difficult personalities and huge egos. And we see it. And I think that's the problem, is that people clash, because the people that gravitate to this subject are people like that have huge egos and very opinionated. And they've got one aspect of it, you know, that they're thinking, no, this is right. This is a Zapruder film was altered. Well, you know, they're going after one part of it. And they're pushing everything. David Lifton's altered, you know, the body alteration. There's always something there, and then they kind of build everything around that, and then people clash over that.
Right. And I step back. I don't want to be a part of that anymore. You know, I mean, there was a time when I would have liked to have been invited to this conference or that conference, and I did go to conferences, and I did speak at conferences. And I sat on the stage with Arlen Specter in Pittsburgh at one of the WEC conferences. Mm-hmm. And I even got up and introduced myself to him.
How was that?
I mean,
because Arlen Specter, I mean, he seemed like a nice guy, but come on, he invented the single bullet theory. I mean, how did you handle yourself around him?
Well, I went up to say hello, because I was, like, five people were on the stage, and I thought, well, that's what you do. And he looked at me and he said, "I know who you are."
Oh.
And that was the. And I just stepped back. That was it.
Oh, okay.
But I did hard, you know, too, because I had a different view of Garrison.
Right.
Anyway.
Yeah. Well.
Whatever.
Yeah, well, I think that, you know, so you heard, because you and I talked about this. You're obviously very upset about this book, and I can understand why. But I do want to assure you that I sent you that that link to the discussion on the education forum, where Jim DiEugenio is definitely going to write a hit piece on this and a critical piece on it. He's definitely not in favor of the book's premise, but Paul Hoke apparently did speak favorably of it. I don't know any. I can't believe anybody that doubts the official story would not see through. I mean, just look at the title, "Cruising for Spirit."
I know, but look at how many people were on the email list getting this information about that book. Yeah. It was everybody in the field.
Well, hopefully it didn't fool anybody. I mean, Paul Hoke has always been, you know, sorry, there's a lot of doubts about him, and if he was fooled by this book, but I mean, just the title, even if you were maybe somehow interested in the premise, which I don't know what the premise would be, but it's how would the Kennedy assassination be a sex crime in anyone's eyes? Does that mean that Garrison thought Clay Shaw? I mean,
well, it's funny. The Garrison was attacked also. They invented some of the CIA assets around the case, invented the story that Garrison molested a boy in the New Orleans Athletic Club. And that created, that made the rounds also. And I think that was the whole idea. It's not so much Garrison. It's a way of discrediting anyone who says that there was not a conspiracy, that Oswald, that doesn't say that Oswald did it.
Right.
That's what, that there's a strong effort to keep that view alive.
Absolutely.
Oswald did it, and we don't want to talk about it anymore. And anyway, look at Garrison. He's this, he's this, he's this.
Right.
And none of it is true of Garrison.
No, and it's in their interest, because anything that they can, the public is, you know, so easily swayed sometimes that they can, I mean, I don't know why, even if Garrison, there was anything to this at all, where Garrison was a homophobe, which we know he wasn't, but even if that was the case, that doesn't make the Warren Report right. I mean, I you know, and it doesn't even necessarily
make
Garrison.
If you can back the person that challenged the Warren Report, then the challenge goes away. That's the view.
Yeah, that's definitely the view. But, I mean, we saw this, you know, the book that came out by Anthony Lewis and Lawrence Schiller. I think Lawrence Schiller is still alive. You talk about a scavenger. I mean, this is a guy that was
right.
In JonBenet Ramsey's and all that kind of stuff. And this guy's been around forever. I think he's still alive. And they co-wrote that book, The Critics and Scavengers of the Warren Report, where they tried to portray all the early critics. Penn Jones as a drunk, and, you know, Weisberg as a crazy chicken farmer, and Mark Lane, I don't know what they did with him, but
saying that Anthony Lewis was part of this?
Yes, Anthony Lewis and Lawrence Schiller, yeah.
Because, you know, I ran into Anthony Lewis at a conference at NYU, mm-hmm. Nothing to do with the Kennedy assassination. And I went up to him at the end, because I knew he had written so much about Garrison. And I said to him, I'm writing a biography. At that time, I was writing the book. And he turned white. I said, I was writing a biography of Jim Garrison. The man literally turned white. There's something about this.
Yeah. Well, sure.
So I mean, that ended the...
Because if you under, there's so many domino effects with all these events. Because, you know, if you, I don't think Robert F. Kennedy would have ever been assassinated if JFK hadn't. I think that, and I'm probably not Martin Luther King either. I think those assassinations are all linked in some way. Mm-hmm. So when you start peeling away the lens, certainly we know Vietnam would have been different. We don't know anything else either. The 60s would have been completely different. But they've got a vested interest in this. You start pulling away something, you know, I call the JFK assassination the mother of all conspiracies. Because this is the one that, you know, you're a little bit older than me, but I know I was 7 years old when he was killed. And as a Catholic family, I mean, you know, we were all crushed because, you know, Kennedy was one of ours, you know. I just remember nothing but crying and weeping in the house. And nobody in my family believed the official story for 1 second. And so I, as a 7 year old, I, you know, absorbed all that, you know, so it's and then when I started actually reading about it, I said, wow, they were right. They didn't even know. They were just going on hunches. But it's a powerful, you know, emotional thing. The nonstop coverage on television and, you know, this, which at that time, you know, TV usually went off the air at a certain hour, but that was on all the time. And it made a huge impression on me. I'm sure as you, as a teenager or whatever you were, it must have made an even bigger impression.
But you know, looking now, what I'm more concerned about is the attack on the idea of the truth, that there is such a thing as truth.
Yeah.
And that's the Trump thing. And
right.
And somehow, when I look back at all of this, part of the attack, many of the attacks, why the people who criticized the Warren Report were treated so harshly, is that that was a way of undermining the truths that had been discovered by a variety of writers and people.
Sure. And that makes, if it can be eventually admitted, if the historians ever, you know, admitted that, God, you know, all these people, even though they fought with each other, the Lane and the Weisbergs and all these are the people that, you know, through their Freedom of Information Act lawsuits and their hard work and going to Dallas and places in New Orleans and interviewing all these witnesses that professional journalists had, New York Times had no interest in, Washington Post had, CBS, none of these people had interest in them. If they can figure out that wow, they were right, what does that say about the mainstream media that failed to do their job? Because they did
right.
not do their job at all.
Job was to cover it up.
Yeah.
That was their job. Dan Rather and the, you know, that was their job. And anything else could not be admitted into the mainstream media.
No, absolutely not. And you, so with you, when you, I'm sorry, go ahead.
No, I was just going to add that's true to this day. You could not get on a mainstream media, even Morning Joe, which is a phony CIA operation.
Absolutely.
You could never, any of these programs.
No, and it just, that's why you talk about Trump. Trump's fake news thing is, that was something that now everybody uses. Because basically everybody, both sides use, if they don't believe, which it's fake news. And so everybody goes, well, most of the news is fake. So, you know, it's almost impossible to I don't think there's any source anywhere now. I mean, I don't trust the media to tell me the truth about anything. So what source would anybody trust? There's no source out there that people trust at this point, and with good reason.
Well, I'm sort of writing a book, a sort of a memoir of my investigation.
Wow.
Because it took so many years, and all the lies and the things that happened and the things, the betrayals, and the people that you even trusted, and then they turned out that they didn't tell you the truth.
Cool. That'd be great. I'd be very interested in reading that.
So I'm trying to write. It's very hard to write that, though, because I don't know. I can't remember it all, even.
Well, yeah. I mean, just remember what you can, I guess. And but it's, you've got such a history with this, so you know what. So eventually, your experience with Garrison, to whatever degree you met him, and I thought you worked for him, but whatever. But you were there and your husband, and you got to know him to some degree. So years later, you decide to write A Farewell to Justice. So you must have been strongly motivated to try to set the record straight about him even then, because that came out after JFK, Oliver Stone's JFK, didn't it?
God, I can't remember. It came out in the year that the book was actually out. That was 2005.
Oh, okay.
So
definitely.
What was...
Yeah, JFK was 91. So yeah, okay, yeah.
Yeah. And then I had a chance to rewrite it and have a new edition in time for the 50th anniversary, right? The 50th?
Yeah, 50th. Yeah,
2013.
Yeah, right.
Is that the 50th anniversary?
Yeah, 2013 would be the 50th, yep.
2013, I'm sorry.
Yeah.
2013. And so that was the edition that you'd see today. I rewrote a lot of it. I added a lot. You know, things kept coming in even after I published it. So I was really happy with it. The title comes from Garrison. He wanted to write a book called A Farewell to Justice. And among his manuscripts, there is a manuscript called A Farewell to Justice. It was just a kind of a book about the case. He wrote so many books and so many manuscripts.
Yeah.
He wanted to be a writer.
Yeah, I think he wanted to be a novelist originally, yeah.
Yeah, and in fact, when after I got to know him, he would send me manuscripts to edit and to help him with. Mm-hmm. To get my, you know, I was creative writing, and mm-hmm. he was wanting help. And he'd call you up in the night and talk about it.
Well, I envy you, man. That's pretty cool to be able to talk to Jim Garrison late at night. That's lucky you.
No, but I mean, these took hours, these calls.
Go ahead, I'm sorry.
At that time, I wasn't writing about him. Mm-hmm. I think I only started my investigation of his investigation in 1997.
Okay, yeah, because for some reason I thought the book came out before 2005. But Garrison was still, when you watch clips of him, that voice, his voice was so impressive that he had a way of making everything sound significant, you know? Or he just,
No, he was an intellectual.
Yes.
And you couldn't talk small talk with him. He wouldn't ask you what were you doing or anything. It was all ideas. He only wanted to talk about ideas. And he was also a Democrat with a small D, which meant that he would prosecute Klan. There were a lot of bombings by the Ku Klux Klan in those years when he was district attorney, and most of the time they got away with it. And if they were caught, Garrison always brought them to trial. And I'm not saying he was perfect, but he was really in favor of justice and the truth and the civil liberties and all of those things. He really was. The only one I remember that was difficult was he had a rapist that was a notorious rapist in the French Quarter, and they finally caught him. His name was Leonard Caesar. And he couldn't get the witnesses to testify. Everybody was terrified, absolutely terrified. He'd come in through the balcony, and he was like a very, very athletic, jump out the window, and when finally Garrison got him, he couldn't get the people to testify. So what they did was they sent him, what they could do was to put him in the East Louisiana State Hospital at Jackson, an insane asylum. This has nothing to do with the Kennedy assassination, so maybe we shouldn't go into that. But I'm just saying, in any case, Leonard Caesar in the insane asylum threw a note out the window saying, "Help me." And the note was taken to the judge in the court at East Feliciana Parish. His name was John Rarick. Now, John Rarick was a classmate of Garrison's at law school. And Rarick called up Garrison and said, "Try him or set him free." See, these people, they could be, never mind. They could be racist, they could be whatever, but they stood for things. And John Rarick stood for truth, and in any case, Garrison put him in the asylum. And John Rarick got him out.
The links to your books are just coming up in the chat, right? I'm just amazed that you had not only A Farewell to Justice, but Jim Garrison, His Life and Times, The Early Years, and then you have Lyndon.
I'm talking about the story about Garrison and the rapists and the cases that came before him when he was district attorney, and he had been an assistant district attorney before that. All those, I had to put in a separate book for all those cases because it is to be over 1,000 pages. So that's why those stories, but they're very important in understanding Garrison. If you understood those stories and what he was like as an officer of law, you could never think that he could be prosecute the Kennedy assassination as a sex crime.
How would you even do that? Obviously it's a subtitle designed to grab people with a hit, but it's stupid. If you just think about it for a second, how would you prosecute that? Clay Shaw was sexually infatuated with John Kennedy? That doesn't even make any sense. I mean, it's the important thing is, like we said, is it that the reason this book is being written and it's getting people praising like a Fred Litwin, he's the newest lone nutter on the block. He's got I'm sure you've probably heard him. He's got a book out now. I would never read it, but he's the one now that's taken up.
Isn't he a Canadian?
I think so, but he's because John McAdams died, I guess, last year, and so Fred Litwin seems to have taken his place as the most vocal lone nutter out there. And so he's he goes on these pages on Facebook and so forth, and just, you know, debates people with the same old discredited nonsense that and some of the younger, you know, some of the younger researchers, unfortunately, don't have the knowledge that people that have been studying for decades do, and they don't know how to, you know, immediately shut down these guys. But it's
right.
And I worry about the young people that are impressionable that can, you know, can buy these arguments, and I see it all the time, and it just, that's why it really incenses me and somebody in the media. And that's why I know you and I feel differently about Oliver Stone, but
Why I feel that way about Oliver Stone. It has nothing to do with the Kennedy assassination. It has to do with he made a series of films about the history of America.
Yes.
With the world history.
Right.
And he was and in one of these is one that has to do with the Spanish Civil War. Mm-hmm. And he praises Stalin in this film for having sent recruits to help the loyalists. And the truth is that those people that went to Spain from Russia, the Soviet Union, they were all murdered by Stalin when they returned. And their purpose was not to help the loyalists. It was to destroy the left-wing movements, in which you see in Homage to Catalonia and in other books. There's a strong Trotskyist movement, and it was not the Communist Party, and Stalin wanted to wipe that out by sending these recruits to Spain. So that's what their purpose was. It's a horrible story, and Stone swallows it in this film. And I met his co-author at a conference, one of these conferences, and I said, listen. You have to correct that program about Spain, and there are books about it. You don't need me. And they just turned against me like madly.
Hmm. And, well, did you ever get to talk to Oliver Stone himself?
No. Okay. I mean, I met him many times, but not on this topic because he wouldn't. You know, that was the end of it. I mean, yeah. He's not a nice man, if you want to know.
Well, I'm sorry to hear that. I'm friends with his son, Sean Stone, who is a very nice guy. And I don't know what the relationship is there, but his son, Sean, is really, really a great guy. And although I'm not sure, you know, maybe I don't know what the relationship is between him and Oliver. I'd just be speculating. But at any rate, you know.
Well, I tell you that after I did that and I spoke about Spain to his co-author, he turned against me and said, and had wrote out of something on the internet, which said that the only good book about Garrison was by Jim DiEugenio. And then he went on to make this documentary film about with Jim DiEugenio.
Yes.
Which I gather is coming out soon. Mm-hmm. You know, and they didn't ask me to even be interviewed on it.
I don't care.
I don't want to do it anyway, but. Still, it was sort of shocking to me because when I was speaking at a conference about Oliver Stone, and I said nothing but good things about him, that was before this. He was just promoting that series of history films.
Mm-hmm.
Anyway, that's maybe not our topic either. I don't know.
Well, that's fine. I mean, you say what you want to say. There's a lot of, you know, I think a lot of the problem in the research community and life in general maybe is people need to speak openly. You know, you don't have to maybe just open wounds where they don't need to be. But if there's something going on there where there's that, then I think
I feel very passionately about Spain. That's right. What's interesting to me. Not how, you know, Oliver Stone will be forgotten.
Right.
His history, you know. Anyway, I don't know. See, I'm in a very strange mood because of the death of Dave Lewis this week.
Yeah, talk about that.
Dave Lewis was the chief intelligence officer on the USS Liberty. And I was, when I first started, I was writing a book about Lyndon Johnson. Mm-hmm. And someone said to me, you really should deal with the USS Liberty. I never heard of it. I didn't know what that was. And so I went out and did the research. And one of the first people I met was Dave Lewis, because he was very open about discussing how one of the admirals had told Dave when the incident was over about Lyndon Johnson and how Lyndon Johnson canceled the rescue of the USS Liberty and left them to die. And so we became friends. Excuse me. And we spoke, I mean, for years, we would just speak together. And he was an honest man. I was so tired of all these people. But he always told the truth. Always. And so he was able to help me. I had never been in the Navy. I didn't know the terms even. You know, who was a captain and who was whatever.
I wouldn't either.
And so I want to say commander, right? Commander.
Yeah.
And anyway, he taught me a lot about the Navy, a lot about the military, a lot about the structure of, you know, ships. And this was a surveillance ship. So it was really, an intelligence ship. And we became friends. We spoke every day, I think, till this last week. He was now 90 years old. And I was just, I knew he was sick, and I knew he had pneumonia at the end. And it comes as a shock. You're never going to talk to that person again.
Sure.
And I can't tell you how it felt. So then this comes on the same day as this. I find out about this book about Garrison and the sex crime, or whatever. So I just feel kind of at loose ends and feel strange. And I still have to write my obituary of Dave. They're collecting obituaries on the Veterans of the USS Liberty website.
Mm-hmm.
So I promised I would do that. And I talked to his wife. And so I'm a little, I don't know what to say. But
sure.
I'm very interested that you care about my experiences investigating the Garrison case.
Well, I do, and I care. I mean, I wish we had more because, I mean, I'd like to discuss it all because that's interesting that you got involved in Blood in the Water, I think, was the book about the Liberty. That was kind of a departure
right.
for you. And then you wrote a book about our man in Haiti, about George Morenschild, who I'm very interested in, and then a book about Marilyn Monroe. I don't know. Any of you want to mention anything about any of those? I mean, there's so many other books, but those ones really kind of jump out at me.
No. The thing that you should try to find out is how George de Morenschild was recruited mm-hmm. by CIA. He was close to CIA. Mm-hmm. Did he kill Kennedy or get involved with that? No, I don't think so. Not at all. Mm-hmm. Maybe his assignment in Dallas was to look over Lee Harvey Oswald.
Right.
And see what he was up to. But that's it. When he went to Haiti, he went to make money.
Sure. Well, what do you think of Bill O'Reilly's involvement there? I mean, Bill O'Reilly just completely made up a huge story about that and got away with it.
Well, you know, he had a TV station, right? A big
yes.
TV
station.
Yes, Fox TV. And, you know, I happened to be friends in the course of my interviewing with the De Morenschild. I ran into a CIA guy, no, and I can't remember his name, but it's in the book, and he had a date with de Morenschild for lunch the day after he was killed. So this man, God, what was his name? Dwyer? Anyway, I haven't got my books in front of me right now, but he said he couldn't possibly have committed suicide. Because he had a date for lunch with me, and we set up where and what and how to go, and he would never have done. He was just not that kind of man that would have done that.
Well, there's so many elements to it. I mean, O'Reilly claims that he was literally ringing the doorbell of de Morenschild's house when he heard the shot, and even though he's the Gaten Fonzie's answering machine has a call from O'Reilly at the same time saying, "Why didn't you tell me de Morenschild was down?" I mean. It's so obvious that he's lying, but the guy got away with it. And then we have the audio recording. I don't know if people have even heard it because apparently someone there was recording the soap operas. A lot of stuff going on there. But I think all of us that have studied this for a long time don't believe for a second that he killed himself. He was one of the many people that died right around the time the House Select Committee on Assassinations was going to call him as a witness.
Well, Dave Gayton Fonzie was impeccable.
Yeah.
As a truth teller. So I would believe everything that you hear that comes from Gayton Fonzie. I'll never forget when I was talking to Fonzie about the House Select Committee interviews, mm-hmm. and they were about to have a Bernardo de Torres on there. Mm-hmm. And Gayton Fonzie was in the audience that day. And he said, look at this guy. Why did they choose this guy? Of all the thousands of Cubans that were in Miami to be interviewed here. And it was so obviously smoothly organized, and a lot of that information. If you're still doing research on that,
sure. I'm doing research on a lot of stuff. I'm writing Hidden History 3 now, so I'm going into a lot of things, a lot more aspects of the JFK assassination, and certainly.
There was a fellow. You'll have to remind me of these names, who did the report on Mexico City.
Oh, yes. Was it Rodriguez? What was his? Oh, God. Somebody probably helped me in the chat room. I know who you're talking about. It was one of the best things. Yeah, exactly.
What was his name?
Was it Eddie Rodriguez?
Eddie Lopez.
Eddie Lopez. That was it. Okay. There you go. Close.
Lopez. Well, he was a lovely guy. And I met him. I didn't interview him. It was too late. Everything crossed. But he worked with Fonzie closely. And he's a guy to talk to. I don't know if there's a period at which he stopped talking to anyone, but you could probably round him up now.
Well, I heard is Dan Hardaway, the guy that worked with him, I think he's in my area or something. I need to look some of these people up. I do try. Pardon me?
I said Hardaway is a dishonest guy.
Oh, I thought he wrote the report with Lopez.
Eddie Lopez is the good guy.
Okay, I remember. I only want to talk to the good guys.
Talking to you as if I'm not on the radio, and because I can't censor myself.
Oh, it's fine. This is basically. I mean, this is going out on a lot of places on the internet. But yeah, I mean, you don't need to censor anything. This is free speech.
But I just want. I have to stop you when you're talking about somebody that I think is not credible.
Good. That's good. I want to know your opinion. Well, you like Mark Lane still. You admire Gaetan Fonzie. Yes. Obviously Garrison. What other people are you still like when you think are most credible?
Fonzie's book is credible.
Yes.
It's called The Last Investigation.
Right. I read it. Yep.
But Eddie Lopez wrote the Mexico City report. That's what it was.
Yes.
And he's also someone that you could talk to. You don't. There aren't that many.
No.
You know, there aren't that many, but all those are good.
Oh, that's cool. Yeah, because that's the problem is that there's so many. I'm relegated now when I'm talking to. I talk to a lot of the children. You know, these people because they're not here anymore. So, and hopefully you can get something from them. I'm very interested in Patrick Dean. Who is a Dallas sergeant? And I feel differently than most critics do. I think something is going on there. I think he's been treated not very kindly by the researchers either. I think he was actually may have been trying to tell the truth, but that's me. I'm still trying to find that. Do you know anything about that?
No. Remind me of who Patrick Dean is or what.
Well, he was a Dallas police sergeant and. A lot of most of the critics blame him and claim he actually because he was friends with Jack Ruby, that he was the one that let Jack Ruby into the basement that day. But Dean, if you read his testimony, I'm sure you've read the testimony. Most of the testimony in the Warren Commission exhibits is really boring. I mean, it's just excruciating to read most of it. You know, it's pages and pages of padding the record. You know, and when did you get married? Where did you go to school? Where did you work? Nonsense. And then they don't ask relevant questions. But Patrick Dean requested to come back. He demanded a return to talk to the Warren Commission, and he directly accused counsel Bert Griffin of threatening him by saying, Jack Ruby did not tell you that he entered the Main Street ramp, and Jack Ruby did not tell you that he thought ahead of time of killing Lee Harvey Oswald. So it was really – and he said he did this during one of those off-the-record discussions. So that alone – and then he talked about this film – that apparently was a Canadian named Ralph Simpson that nobody's ever seen that supposedly showed the sixth floor window. So fascinating stuff. But I talked to his daughter, and he ended up – he had a mysterious car accident that the family thinks was, another attempt to kill a witness, that he survived. But he was never quite the same, forced to retire. And he, like a lot of these people, was kind of fearful and paranoid later on. But I find him to be a fascinating character.
Hmm. I don't know how you're going to get so interested in that now.
Well, I've been studying this for so long. The minutia still gets me. And I realize maybe it doesn't matter to most people because they don't know who these people are, these names of these witnesses, but they matter to me still. So, I try to, put it into an overall context that more people understand. But, I don't want to lose the young people, because that's what I'm afraid of, is that – and I don't think too many young people will be taken by Cruising for Conspirators, this stupid new book, but you never know. It might – I don't know. It might – maybe some gay readers will see it and say, just respond to it because of that. So it is dangerous that somebody can put out that kind of disinformation. And if you haven't read the really good critical works, you don't have a base of knowledge. So this – you may be persuaded by this kind of nonsense.
They obviously think that it's worth something, or you wouldn't have Max Holland getting on it on his website.
Sure. Well, he's obviously pushing the Oswald did it mantra. Well, it's basically Holland and Posner. Bugliosi's gone, so you have Holland and Posner and this new guy Fred Litwin, and they're very vocal. But what I've said for a long time, Joan, is that – and I used to try to be – I was the kumbaya guy on the JFK forums. That's why I wasn't very popular. Because I would call them out on, their squabbling and everything. And I'd say, we need to come together. And I even tried to write a consensus one time. Let's write a short consensus statement that we can all agree with. And I forget what it was. But if you look on the Ed forum, you'll see it. And you should have seen the responses. They just quibble over this word, that word. And they can't do it. And I tried to tell them, all these lone nutters, they never fight with each other. They're in solidarity with Oswald did it. They don't care about anything else. But our side squabbles over who did it and, their little pet theory. You're stupid because you don't accept this, you don't accept that. And I don't know why they can't coalesce behind – the main point is that we were lied to and we're still being lied to, that whatever happened, it wasn't what you've been told. Lee Harvey Oswald did not do it, whatever happened.
Mm-hmm.
Now, you agree with that,
right?
I should be a teacher. Well, I did. It amazed me for a while there, for several years. My Fairfax County, Virginia adult education program allowed me to teach a course. First, it was on the JFK assassination, and then it went to film. So I taught a course on Oliver Stone's JFK. The easiest job I've ever had. We just played the film, and I'd stop it constantly and, make my little points, and then we'd discuss it at the end. I mean, it was – I loved it, but now that's gone. I don't know, because the COVID and everything, it messed up all the classes, so we still never got back to doing it. But so I have a little teaching experience, but I would love.
Because I think that you'd have an audience that to whom all this is new.
Yeah, that's what. And what used to frustrate me though, Joan, is that like in my classes, there would always be at least one lone nutter there. And I've always thought, that I could be persuasive. And I put together a PowerPoint presentation that I thought was – put all the best and strongest evidence in there that just showed, how absurd this official story is. But if that guy came in as a lone nutter, and a lot of times they were young people, it really frustrated that they believed it. They weren't persuaded. And I thought, I don't know what I can do. I can't put forth a more powerful case than this. And they –
every
still –
one of them. If you lose a few, so what? Yeah. I had one smart aleck once in one of my classes who said, why do we need two Oswalds?
Yeah.
Why did they need? Because they had these articles. I had that, what's the name of that fellow?
John Armstrong?
John Armstrong, right, exactly.
Right. Yeah.
And he wrote out a summary of his work for me, and I Xeroxed for the students. So it was like 100 pages or something, maybe less. And I gave it out, and we read it. And what can I say to that? Somehow, you have to sort of have faith in the story, you know?
Yeah, you're right. You
didn't need to. The truth is, you didn't need to.
Right, exactly.
Maybe there I don't know. But, you know, John was so adamant about the Hungarian one and then the other one and all of that.
Well, John's been on the show. You know, I've talked to him many times. But yeah, I mean, he's another one. I mean, I think he did, and I've defended it many times. I think he did a lot, and it was a hard work. And he spent his own money on it. He did a lot of great research, but, you know, I don't necessarily have to buy the whole theory, but he found some interesting stuff, definitely.
Mm-hmm. Some of that research was done by Malcolm Blunt.
Yes, the guy
in
the
UK. Did he ever tell you that?
No. But I haven't talked to him that much. In fact, he wanted me to call a witness, and I haven't heard from him for a while, and I didn't really want to call this witness for him. So I don't know. He's probably mad at me because of that. But he was on this show, and he doesn't do too many interviews. And but, you know, it's him. David Lifton's another one, too. I mean, he was a very difficult individual. But, you know, I disagree with him on a lot of stuff. But
he's not an honest guy, I don't think, David Lifton. Yeah. I gave him things, but he wanted more and more and more and more and more. Sure, I have a whole – of course, I did the research, a lot of research, so naturally. And I didn't – and then I stopped.
Yeah.
Well, so he didn't call me anymore. And then, of course, he never did his book.
Yeah, I don't know. He's been promoting that book for like 15 years, and it never comes out, the biography of Oswald or whatever. Yeah, I don't know. I don't know what's up with it.
I mean, Mary Farrell gave him money to live during that period.
Yeah, I heard that. The foundation. I don't know, but that's for those who aren't familiar with that. Those are the kind of people for. We have Chuck. Chuck wants to know. Tell him how great Malcolm Blunt is. Chuck wants your opinion.
Oh well, I couldn't begin to tell you. tell you something about Malcolm. He gives material to people that don't deserve it. He'll give anybody anything. I accused him of being the Pied Piper of Hamelin. You know, when he led the rats to the sea, I sort of see that, and I don't agree with that. I sort of am more guarded about things.
Mm-hmm. Sure,
if you don't trust giving out all this good material, but Malcolm's a brilliant researcher. Oh boy, he knows the National Archives better than any other human being, including people working for the government. Fabulous.
I need to bend his ear because I've never talked to him, and I've heard obviously you and Chuck both are speaking. Chuck is saying great man, so I will definitely have to do that. But I want you to sum up in a minute and promote comment from the chat room. I love Joan for many reasons. Her examination of Mac Wallace is superb. Her work on Garrison is unmatched. So I'm sure you have lots of fans like that, and you know, your work on Garrison is superb, and I need to read more of your stuff. I would love to have an autographed copy of any of your books. So just know that I'm sitting here waiting.
You asked for, and
I kind of hinted at it. You know, I'm a pretty good beggar. I kind of hinted at it, but if you have any, gosh, I'd love it. I'd love to have something signed by you, and it would be an honor to put in my library.
You never gave me your address, maybe you did, listen.
I'll email it to you. You want me to email it to you?
Sure. Email's good.
I will do that. That would be wonderful. But we're just about at – I just want to give you time, though. If you have anything you especially want to promote, anything coming up, you said you're writing something now. What do you want to promote, or what do you especially – you know, anything you want to say? You take a couple minutes, and the floor is yours.
I don't know what I want to say. I never promote myself.
Well, you should.
Are you there?
Yeah, you should. Well, but I mean, you don't have to. But I mean, you can talk about your what's your website again? You have the URLs that.
I need to bring it up to date.
It's Joan Mellon.
But I don't want to write it. Right? I believe that the best thing we can do for people that like this conspiracy of the sex crime book, I think the best thing we could do is to ignore it.
Right. Exactly. It's
not to. Because I tell you something, in the old days, years ago, Mary Farrell told me that Judith was not credible. It was all no good. And this was years and years ago. And somehow Mary, I said, well, Mary, make it, you know, speak up. And she didn't want to do it. And when the publishers that were considering the work asked Mary, she wouldn't answer. And then I thought it. I mean, I took Mary's word on that. And then look what happened now.
Yeah, she's probably got the biggest fan base of any of anybody in the community now.
That's right. And all the she's taken over all the. I remember when Deborah Conway wouldn't open the door to let her in.
Yeah, exactly. Well, the music, so it's the website is joanmellon.com. Joan, I could talk to you all the time, and we'll have to talk again soon. I thank you so much for coming on the show.
Appreciate it.
Time of fake news, fake politicians, and fake fiat currency, it's getting harder to find the genuine article. That's why when it comes to precious metals, I call the team I can trust. This is David Knight for my friends at Wise Wolf Gold and Silver Exchange. Proudly veteran-owned and operated, Wise Wolf Gold and Silver Exchange is your home for gold and silver coins, bullion, jewelry, and more. Prices and inventory are updated daily, so you get the most competitive possible pricing. And when it's time to sell your gold and silver items, they pay top dollar. Wise Wolf Gold and Silver Exchange also accepts and deals in Bitcoin. Call or text the owner, Tony Arterburn, today at 888-667-1836. That's 888-667-1836. Or just go to wisewolf.gold. From bullion to Bitcoin, Wise Wolf Gold and Silver Exchange.
Wise Wolf Gold and Silver Exchange.
Hi, this is Ron Paul. You're listening to The Donald Jeffries Show.
Ochili.com.
Go ahead, caller.
Hey, I'm interested in the truth about the JFK assassination.
Right, well, what do you want to know?
Judy Baker's wild claim, Oswald girlfriend, she knew Ruby and Barry, cancer weapons. Really?
I imagine I could claim I have four wheels. It doesn't make me a wagon, but okay.
Oswald was on the kill team and trying to prevent the murder of John Kennedy. Come on now, has a real expert on the JFK assassination look into her claims?
Go to Amazon.com, enter Judith Baker in her own words, you'll get results for a digital copy of a book where Walt Brown utilizes her own words and the known evidence in the case to get at, well, a different perspective, let's say. You can get Judith Barry Baker in her own words from the author himself, signed if you request it, by contacting Dr. Brown at KIASJFK@AOL.com. It's a fun book, and it actually dissects the many, many fantastic claims. Judith Barry Baker in her own words.
Thank you for all the great information.
The views expressed by callers, co-hosts, or anyone else who happens to get on the air at Ocelli.com do not necessarily reflect the views of Ocelli.com or Chuck Ocelli, and we are not responsible for any stupidity which might ensue. Thank you.
WallStreetWindow.com. Gold, silver, the stock market. WallStreetWindow.com.
Perhaps you're invested deeply.
Perhaps you're not in deep enough. Maybe you're thinking about getting started. WallStreetWindow.com. Michael Swanson, the brilliant author of The War State, understood these trends professionally for many years, and now he gives you the benefit of his knowledge. WallStreetWindow.com. Go there now. Go there now. Go there now.
Revelation through conversation.
Hi, this is Cindy Sheehan. You're listening to The Donald Jeffries Show.
Jeffries Show.
Welcome back to the Donald Jeffrey Show. Sorry for we're having technical glitches here. Not sure what's happening, but so you probably didn't hear the music. I'm not sure what you were hearing. You might have been hearing a different kind of music. But at any rate, yeah, because it's a short segment and we had these problems, we won't be taking calls tonight. So, and I see Pete, my friend Peter, see Caution, he's asking me where's the second hour. Hope it's here now, Pete. Sorry it's sorry it's a little late. So I hope you guys enjoyed Joan Mellon. Very interesting lady, and you know, needless to say, she's got a history that goes back, obviously, to Garrison. So, not too many people have been researching this thing longer than I have now. There's not too many of them left, so it's always wonderful to be able to talk to somebody that's been at it longer than I have. Not too many people have. So we'll just go over some things. Obviously, you know, I go to these conspiracy websites and I find headlines that. They draw my attention. Sometimes I go to mainstream websites as well, but I found this one, and I don't know if Jacob's still in the chat room. Hope you're still there, Jay. He and I have discussed this in communications about this this absurd. You know, I badmouth the woke left a lot, obviously, and you listen to me, you know that. But so I need to talk about the some conservative propaganda that is very strong. Good job, Jay. Okay, well, you're going to like this, Jay. And I don't know if you saw that. I sent this story to you. But it's headline, Man Proves Labor Story is Pure BS, applies to 60 entry-level jobs, gets one interview, companies just aren't hiring. And I love reading stuff like this because it's by people that are out there. And, of course, they, you know, who knows? I guess they could be making this up. But I like hearing from people who are actually out there because the propaganda on the right – is still it's always strong. It's basically they're hiring. I see for help wanted signs everywhere. You know, I've heard that so many times in the course of my life, and I've tried to point out that you sent it to me first, Jay. Oh. Okay, I don't know how I missed that one. Oh, sorry about that. I get a lot of stuff. People send me a lot of stuff. Oh well, here I thought I was sending you something, but I figured should have known you'd be on top of it, but. It basically says, and I've heard other people, you know, that have talked about this as well. And I know from my own experience, you know, after I was fired for helping out a handicapped coworker 4 years ago, I made some effort to stay within the actual labor pool before deciding to become an incredibly lowly paid full-time writer. But, you know, I had one interview. That was it. Out of all the jobs, and I applied for a lot of jobs. And people I know, family members and so forth, it's kind of been the standard experience that I know of. Chuck says he's not in the email chain. Well, this isn't an email chain. This is just Facebook messaging because Jay and Pete, who's on here too, Peter and Chris, who, again, I'm wishing Chris the best. The chat room is always going to be quieter without him. He's going through a difficult time. Maybe he's listening out there. If so, I good thoughts of you, Chris, and I hope things get better. Hopefully he'll be back in the chat room sometime. Jay says, yes, and we got Greg Abbott in Texas talking about all the jobs the state is creating after he is directing the state's elite, shut down the state. Yeah, I mean, that's what, you know, is still deadly about that stupid, incredibly dumb duopoly, the two-party system, is that both parties, you can just take the labels off, you know who's talking, and it's the same stuff. When they get in office, they brag about these employment numbers. And that's what, you know, one of the most radical things Trump did. During his campaign, he said something that I had talked about and written about for a long time. Trump took a lot of my talking points. That's why I was saying, you know, Donald Trump is doing this. But and that is that these phony unemployment numbers, which were changed in the 1990s, where they changed the way they are calculated. So and they did it on purpose. To try to create a rosier picture, because they just count the people that are presently receiving unemployment benefits. And of course, they tightened that up a while back too in the 90s, so that you basically, end result, there is no such thing as welfare anymore. They renamed it. And basically, you have people that are getting less help for shorter period of time than ever before. If you're, I don't know what, you know, again, to what degree illegal immigrants are getting, I don't know. But certainly American citizens are getting less than they have for a very long time. But those unemployment stats were purposely twisted so that, you know, and Trump himself during the campaign said, you know, some people think the real unemployment rate's like 40%, which it might well be. And I thought, right on, this guy is really, you know, but again, I had to know. I couldn't believe it was real, and obviously it wasn't, because as soon as Trump came into office, what was he doing? Bragging about the exact same type of phony stats. And of course, nobody was there. You know, the people that hated him in the press, you know, where were you, CNN? You really hate this guy, right? Why didn't you have talking points in front of you? Hey, you know, Trump, back in 2016, you said this, that this is totally phony. The unemployment numbers are fake. So did you change the way they've been calculated since you've been president? Of course not. But again, nobody ever does that. And so both sides get away with the same nonsense. They are, especially the job creation, which is ridiculous. And at this point, I don't even know what job creation exists, because as Jay points out, Abbott and all the other governors closed these states. So with all the small businesses forced to shut down, who knows how many workers were thrown out of work. So once things started opening up again, to whatever degree they did, and they certainly never going to open up to the extent they did, because those small businesses aren't coming back, or the vast majority aren't, to whatever degree, that is just counted as, you know, basically, okay, you reopened again, that's counted as new jobs, I guess, I'm guessing. But the vast majority of jobs, and the party that's out of power will always point that out. That, you know, if the Democrats are in power, the Republicans will say, well, he's just creating a bunch of minimum wage jobs. And the Democrats will say the same thing with the Republicans' power. And it's true in both cases. Most jobs are simply not paying anywhere near enough to meet the ever-increasing cost of living. And I pointed that out in my book, Survival of the Richest. Let's see. I have a person. Oh, cool. They're not hiring. It's very strange. Some people are reporting that they advertise a certain wage for a particular job, and then they offer you a lower. Exactly. I mean, why hear what some of these rates they claim they're hiring? I mean, but it's obviously not true, because, you know, I wonder what that was. Chuck put a positive message about me. Followed him for years. So it's the first positive message you got about Don outside this chat, and one comment on the website. Well, that's nice to know. I've heard, you know, from people out there, that I wish that those of you that are leaving negative comments or saying, you know, let me know what is it that you don't like. You know, because I like to know, and I don't care. I have thick skin, so people call me lots of names. I, you know, whatever it is, you know, sticks and stones, and I'm not going to change what I am. I'm a populist, and I believe in free speech. I'm for the little guy. And, you know, my hero is Huey Long, because he was for the little guy. And there haven't been too many people in positions of power ever that were for the little guy. And so everything I do, everything I say and write about is an attempt, really, to expose some kind of corruption, some kind of unfairness, some kind of injustice. That's what I'm concerned about. And, you know, I struggle to write about anything else. So now, you know, if that, you know, rubs people the wrong way, I guess it does, you know, but, you know, that's, it is what it is. But but I thought that story was very interesting, and it gave me a chance to kind of bash conservatives, because they are, that is, even with Trump's talk about the rigged system, and everything, the right, especially once Trump got in power, they never got over that embrace of the marketplace, which is what, you know, the main thesis of Survival of the Richest is that the marketplace is utterly rigged and it's corrupt. And of course, Trump was telling you the system was rigged, and he was exactly right. But as soon as he got in charge of it, you know, he didn't fix it. And then suddenly it wasn't rigged anymore, I guess. And, you know, that's it reminds me of when the Republicans and, finally took over Congress under Newt Gingrich in 1994 or whatever it was. And they made all these promises, and some of them were really good. And one of the main things that were was really good was term limits. But as soon as they got in there, and you had a guy, I can't remember the guy's name, but somebody actually beat Dan Rostenkowski, who was one of these, these incredibly corrupt clowns who ended up going to prison, who had been in Congress for decades and was just, basically a mobster. Was just a horrible person. But the Congress is filled with these people that are there for decades. They can't be voted out either because they're not counting the votes or the people are too stupid to vote them out. And either way, it doesn't matter. But that guy, and there was another guy too that ran specifically on term limits. And both of them, when they got in power, they changed their tune. I kind of like this. It's a pretty sweet deal. I don't know if I'm for term limits. Chuck says last week Australian Ben ended up being a guest on my show. Yeah, he told me about it. That's really cool. Australian Ben is somebody who's a big fan of my work, and I'm a fan of his now. And he and I have chatted. He was supposed to be on my iProtest show a couple weeks ago, and they had their biggest technical glitches ever, so we couldn't have him on there. So I'm going to definitely have him on very soon. This week I have a guest, but maybe next week I'll have to contact him and hopefully we can get him on here. But very interesting guy, and certainly he's in the heart of all this stuff. He's where it's happening in Australia, and we don't want to, we don't want to be like that. And today I'm forced with one of these stupid choices now because I got an email this morning from one of my, it's a very heady experience to be friends with some of these people that I admire. Graham Parker is one of my favorite singer-songwriters of all time. His music was a part of the soundtrack of my youth, courtship with my wife, and he was on all the mixtapes I used to play driving around, and just love him. And he's become a friend. He's a really nice guy. He's read Hidden History and loved it. He wrote a blurb for the new Showbiz book coming up, and I've met him a couple times because whenever he comes to Washington D.C., he leaves me tickets to come see him. And so he emailed me today. And that's what's so cool. He's thinking of me. I don't have to prompt him. And he's letting me know he's coming to D.C. And so I said, oh, cool. He yelled at me tickets, but I didn't stop to think about this stupid mask and vaccine nonsense. So sure enough, I look on the City Winery where it's playing. I look on their website, and it's, effective once they're reopening. Anybody that comes to and Jake's posting that distracting picture again, I'm distracted. I've lost my train of thought, Jake. But it says that anybody coming in either has to be vaccinated, which I'm not, and I'm not going to be, or provide proof of a negative COVID test within the last 72 hours. So. I kind of told him to take. So I feel like I almost have to get this stupid. Which I haven't had a COVID test. I don't want to get a stupid COVID test, but I may have to do it. And if I want to see Graham Parker and talk to him after the show and everything. So very, it just amazes me that this stupid stuff is still going on. We're going on 2 years now, and it's absolutely ridiculous. And I see it's. Oh, cool. And Anon 190 said, I finished a new chapter in Crimes over lunch today. Loved it. No idea about the deaths connected with alien and sedition. Yeah, that's great. I appreciate that. I'm not sure who that is, but it must have been somebody I sent the book to. I don't know. But he's referring to Crimes and Cover-Ups in American Politics, 1776, 1963, forward by Ron Paul. The new paperback edition just came out yesterday. And, that was Pete. Okay. You suddenly became anonymous. Thanks, Peter. Yeah. Okay. That makes sense. But, thank you. And, it does have a new, chapter. It's typical Don Jeffries where I go over both sides as far as, and I talk about how the idea of un-Americanism, it should be, the idea of un-Americanism should be un-American to anybody, should be anathema to any lover of liberty or believer in freedom of expression. And it's amazing to me. That's why I blanch at what we see today, where when people talk about hate speech, I keep trying to say, and I'm never going to back down from that. I don't care how many times you say it. hate speech is not compatible with free speech. You can't define it. Hate's a human emotion. But it goes back to, way back to the Alien and Sedition Acts even, but it certainly it goes back from our standpoint. You know, we certainly have still have a strong enough memory historically of the 1950s when at that time to be un-American was to be a commie or a leftist or a pinko, a red, a fellow traveler. And they had plenty of names for him. And now, ironically, thank you, Chuck posted the cover of the book. But now, of course, it's completely flipped. Now it's to be on the right. And instead of commie and all those names, you're a racist, white supremacist, Nazi, whatever. They have, you know, and the same, and they, some of the names cross over. Like, you know, they say traitor now, just like they said traitor back then. Insurrectionists, you know, these things are common terms, but the gist is you're opposing the order, you're opposing the establishment. And of course in the 60s the counterculture opposed basically the right-wing conservative establishment. Now the establishment obviously isn't conservative in, you know, the traditional sense, and the people who are opposing it, the radicals today, are coming at it from the right. And so I just object to that entire term, un-Americanism. And as I point out in Crimes and Cover-Ups, I think I'm the only person to come out strongly in defense of both Joe McCarthy and the Rosenbergs. And I do that in that book. It's a delicate balancing act, but I think I managed to pull it off. But in terms of McCarthy, people, again, Americans are historically illiterate. They don't know their history at all. So when they talk about, well, again, the young Americans don't even know what the House Un-American Activities Committee was, HUAC. But that was, you know, they used to talk about the commie witch hunt. They talked about the House Un-American Activities Committee. And that, by the nature, it's, hello, it's House. Joe McCarthy was never in the House. He was in the Senate. He had nothing to do with that. That was the dangerous part of the witch hunt. The idea that they called anything un-American. Joe McCarthy was concentrating on supposed infiltration from the Soviets into American government positions, and especially the Army. That's when he started getting bad press, and that's eventually when he ended up in Bethesda Naval Hospital at age 49 with a knee problem and died 2 days later, no autopsy given. Same hospital where his friend James Forrestal was pushed out of a window a decade before, Secretary of Defense under Truman. They claimed he jumped. Obviously, he didn't. And, you know, Forrestal told his good friend McCarthy, one of the great lines that I use over and over again to try to, you know, to tell people, you think there's no conspiracy? Well, Forrestal told McCarthy, you know, McCarthy, if there wasn't a giant conspiracy, once in a while, they'd make a mistake in our favor. That's a great line. I use it all the time, and it's absolutely true. If you had a coincidence conspiracy of history, if it wasn't, you know, if it weren't conspirators running us, then once in a while, you know, somebody good would emerge. Something good would happen. Somebody, you'd have a Huey Long that would rise up and say, you know, what we need to do, God, I mean, it's ridiculous. You got one guy over here with $100 billion, and you have some other people over here that are sleeping on the streets. Something's completely out of whack there. You'd have somebody that would say, I think we can figure out how to do it. And that's why you don't have to be a communist to be appalled at the fact, and I wrote about it in the updated paperback edition of Survival of the Riches, which features a foreword by Naomi Wolf. And in that one, I found research that showed that if you divided up all the money in the United States, and this is the known money, I'm not talking about the money where if Huey Long was alive today and he wanted to share the wealth, first thing he'd go to, other than the audit in the Federal Reserve, which he was also the very first high-profile critic of the Federal Reserve. It wasn't even 20 years, barely 20 years old when he first started criticizing it. He already knew how, you know, disastrous it was. But Huey was already looking at the foundations of his day. Imagine that he saw the foundations today, the Gates Foundation, Clinton Foundation, all these, and these are all unaudited, just like the Fed. That's where he would be going. If you divided up all the wealth anyhow, $341,000 for every man, woman, and child in the United States. Not suggesting you do that, but that's what it'd be. That's how much money that's known. That's outside of the foundation. Let's see. Chuck says McCarthy's supposed to be a good guy to you. No, you know, a good bad guys. No, my point was, I think that McCarthy and the Rosenbergs. I think the Rosenbergs were victims of probably genuine anti-Semitism. I think they had the wrong name at the wrong time, and I've looked into their case as well. They certainly weren't guilty of something they should be executed for. I pointed out that Claude Fuchs, who was out at the same exact same time, did basically the same thing, and he served, you know, 10, 15 years in prison, lived a long life. For whatever reason, they made an example out of them, and there's a lot of question about the guilt of either one of them. McCarthy, I think, was a naive guy. He had a lot of Trump characteristics, with that being quite, you know, outgoing as him. But McCarthy, great friend of the Kennedy family, by the way. You know, he was the godfather of Kathleen Kennedy Townsend, the oldest child of RFK, although they've wiped that. The Kennedy family has kind of wiped that from the records, where they're trying to claim that's not true now. You know, it was in a lot of sources for many years. He also dated a couple Kennedy sisters. So, good guy. I don't know if you call him a good guy. I think he was a victim of the phony Cold War, and the Rosenbergs were a victim of the phony Cold War as well. And I think he's been unfairly blamed for things he had nothing to do with. The House Un-American Activities Committee, he had nothing to do with that because he wasn't in the House. And nobody even knows who was on that committee. They just picked, you know, they found a figure to focus on, McCarthy. And he had kind of a Nixon-like look, you know, in some ways with his 5 o'clock shadow. And I think he just he fit the bill. But at any rate, he was 49 years old when he went into Bethesda Naval Hospital with a knee problem, died 2 days later. And even if he was the biggest villain of his age, he was a huge name. You want to do an autopsy on that guy, don't you? But no, I mean, and that's one of the things in my book that I focus on, is how many of these deaths of high-profile figures, going back to Warren Harding, who died under very mysterious circumstances while on a cruise. Some people think his wife killed him. We don't know, but something's political opponents, but died very strangely, no autopsy done. Calvin Coolidge, out of office, drops dead of a heart attack suddenly. No autopsy. Well, we think a heart attack, no autopsy done. Franklin Roosevelt died very, you know, suddenly. A lot, and I'm going to have Steve Ubaney on my iProtest show this Friday. He's going to talk a little bit about that, who killed FDR. no autopsy. Again, president served into his fourth term. I mean, how do you not, you know, want an official cause of death for that? And obviously up and through McCarthy and beyond. More recent times, Anton Scalia. You know, a guy found apparently with a pillow on his head, you know, in a very strange place. And, you know, a pillow was on his face. I mean, that's not, you know, Supreme Court justice. You don't think that deserves an autopsy? Well, none was done. And so that's what we get in history. You find this over and over again. And I when I look at these figures, I look at them dispassionately, so I don't necessarily fall for the conventional view about any of them. And I found more often than not that the people that are demonized were actually pretty much were better in many cases than the people who are lauded as heroes. Not in every case, but so I think that they've the court historians have wrongly ascribed a good guy and bad guy roles to these people. And certainly, you know, what I've written about Lincoln and the war between the states. I mean, I think, you know, there weren't any good guys there, perhaps, but certainly we can't look at the Lincoln and the North. I don't think there's any kind of good guys there. And they also were no less racist, especially by today's standard, than the Confederates were. So we need to stop looking at it through the prism of our own politics. Jay says McCarthy was being run by neocon Jews. Well, he had Roy Cohn around him, and that was, you know, again, it was. Was that by design or whatever? I mean, Roy Cohn was a disreputable character, had mafia ties, and later had ties to Donald Trump. He was I don't know why, how he was inserted himself in there, but people, you know, forget that, you know, Robert F. Kennedy got his start as a young lawyer working for Joe McCarthy, later kind of tried to distance himself from him. But to his credit, when people asked him, I think when McCarthy died, he was asked, or later he was asked about McCarthy, and he said something like he was a complex character. So he didn't attack his old boss and family friend when he could have, and it would have been very popular to do so. and the Fed said, well, whoever killed FDR should get a case of beer, LOL. Well, I don't know. I don't even know. I want to see what the premise of this book is, but certainly FDR is was not one of my favorites, and I think FDR probably, if if, you know, whatever conspiracy took the life of Huey Long, I think FDR was at the center of it because Huey Long was his political enemy, and he was basically accusing them on the floor of the Senate of doing that. Chuck says, makes perfect sense. Roy was part of the Trump family universe. Absolutely was. And that's what people, you know, when they talk about Trump, you know, there's interesting connections there. And one of the most my interesting connection, I think, the most interesting connection of all is his uncle John Trump, who was a high-profile enough figure to be sent by the FBI after Nikola Tesla died. And Nikola Tesla, you know, supposedly had come up with a way to provide free energy to everyone. I think that might have benefited me. I mean, talking about a boon, I think we could use that right about now. But, you know, wireless. He had, you know, invented wireless technology, basically. Incredible stuff. And this guy dies. I mean, I don't know. He was pretty old. I think he was in his 80s. So I don't know if he was knocked off or anything. But I do know his papers and all his research, which were supposedly in several cases of research, disappeared with his death. And John Trump is supposedly the individual that was sent by the government to get those papers, and they have not been seen since. So I would I'd love to see some enterprising Trump-hating reporter ask him that. I mean, again, I'm sure he was, oh, what are you talking about, fake news? Or I'm sure he would have no idea. He might not even know. I mean, who knows? But and let's see. It says, yeah, the Roy Cohn connection to Trump. Absolutely. So and there's, you know, there's another thing that I originally – I don't think if it made the – it was in Survival of the Richest, and I – you know, I don't know if it might have been edited out. You know, Survival of the Richest was my book that they really pared down. I don't know why. They cut – so it's not as long as the other books were. The editor I had for that was a bit – more, I guess, stringent than the others, and they really cut a lot of material out that they thought was redundant. And so one of the things I had on there, this is before Trump entered politics, so I found was really despicable, is that he sued one of the beauty contestants in his whatever contest, Miss Universe, or whatever pageant he used to run. And I think the she was accused, basically she was saying that the pageant was fixed. You know, shocker, wow, beauty pageants are fixed? You know, so Trump sued her. And of course, she ended up losing. Now, of course, you know, what could this see? She didn't, and I, you know, I'd contact so many people and apologize, but I know I tried to contact her. I think I became friends on Facebook with her. But I mean, the only reason I wanted to become friends with her was to ask her about this. I mean, I didn't have any other interest in her beyond that. And I messaged her about it, and I think she just instantly deleted me as a friend or something. So she must not want to talk about it. But, I mean, what else would you want to talk to her about? So I don't know if maybe eventually they made some kind of settlement. But, you know, she lost. So but I thought that was incredibly vindictive that that he, you know, would sue somebody over that. And but I guess, you know, it's a measure of his personality. Italian businessman once said to me, that guy has just enough sense not to stiff us. Yeah. Yeah. But so that headline caught my eye on Godlike Productions, which is, you know, probably the most far out. I know some of you guys out there read it. It's not quite – it used to be better before Trump ruined everything, but he ruined a lot of the great conspiracy forums because before him, you know, there wasn't this divide there. But once Trump came on the scene, the people online, just like the people, you know, in terms just of politics, became divided about him. They either, you know, thought he was the greatest thing since sliced bread, or they hated him, and these conspiracy forums became, you know, debates on Trump, which is not what they wanted. Hey, did all hell late break loose like today, like Bannon said? I didn't hear what Bannon said. Is Bannon still – is between Bannon and Flynn and the MyPillow guy and what's the other one? The lawyer, Lynn Wood, and Sidney Powell. I think they've all said, is it 2 more weeks or whatever? I mean, they've all said so many times that things. And they're not still trying to claim Trump is going to regain power, are they? Because I know that was – I think the MyPillow guy, Mike Lindell, is still saying that. And, you know, again, that's the contempt of Congress, you know, over the subpoena. I don't know. I'm not sure what that over this. I don't know. I really, you know, people like I was interested in Lynn Wood because he was the Kraken lady. Yes, sir. Yeah. Release the Kraken. Yeah. My friend Billy Ray Valentine, when we did our America Unplugged show for a long time, he used to play the clip of her saying, release the, I'm going to unleash the release the Kraken or whatever. And yeah, just that whole thing, just very, very sad because it you know, it talked about, you know, I think Trump can be summed up and really the entire movie. There's lots of sound and fury signifying nothing, to quote Shakespeare, a lot of sound and fury signifying nothing. And just these constant ridiculous, you know, miraculous Hail Marys to think that somehow that, I mean, even if you thought that could happen, I mean, with as authoritarian as the woke left is now, if they tried something where, unlike the ridiculous insurrection on January 6th, if they really tried some show of force like to install, I mean, I don't know how they would even attempt to do it, to put Trump back in power. I mean, there would be, I mean, talking about opposition, I mean, come on, that's just, it's dreaming. But this is what the other side has left, right? Jared Kushner involved in that, Jay? I don't know. I don't know. Jared Kushner's certainly at the center of everything, and he was really at the center of much of what was wrong. A lot of stuff was wrong with the Trump administration, but the fact that he had so much power, Jared Kushner, was absolutely ridiculous, and that certainly made Trump's administration by far the most Zionist supporting one ever. And that's saying something because, you know, cause it's not like we've ever had an administration really that since JFK, I guess, and maybe Jimmy Carter to some degree, that wasn't completely and overtly pro-Zionist. But Trump just, you know, took it to new levels. And Jared Kushner, I think, is one of the main reasons for that. But so he says, where do we go from here? I don't know. Like, I don't know if there's any good way to go. I mean, I feel sometimes like America is and the world, and we're heading on you know, one of those long, I don't know if you guys have in other parts of the country, we have the Beltway and or some parts of, you know, interstate highways where you you go long stretches where you can't turn around. Because you can't drive across, you know, the patch of grass and the median. So you have to wait until eventually maybe there'll be a little gap there where police use sometimes or take the next exit or something. But I feel sometimes that we're on one of those highways where there's no exits, there's nowhere to turn. You can't pull a U-turn anywhere. And we're just bound for the edge of the cliff or whatever you want to call it, whatever dire apocalyptic thing you can think of. And we just seem like we're just headed in that direction, and I don't see any way to stop it. And I wish I did, but I don't. I don't know how. We're going to. I believe things are going to get bad, worse than it is now. Yeah. I don't know. It's hard to imagine that, but yeah. Chuck says, when I was 7 or 8, the most famous Italian businessman I ever met said, "The loud guy in the room is only dangerous to himself." Remember that? Yeah. I mean, you know, people. What's the old expression about being mistaken at the top of his lungs? Yeah, you know, most blowhards are not usually making good points. So you know, it's you really struggle to find anything positive there. And I you know, when your hope is, and you see this on those conspiracy forums where people are, you know, saying bring on the asteroid, things like that, where they're. They want that. I'm walking around with a doom boner. You know, you hear that all the time where, you know, these people are addicted to doom and they want something dire to happen to change the reality because reality is so bad now for most people. And we have this dystopian world staring us in the face, this Orwellian nightmare. And when the best, when the only way out of it that most people can figure is for everything to totally collapse and to turn into a Mad Max Beyond Thunderdome reality. Wow, I mean, if that's what you're looking forward to, but I understand the appeal of that to some level. And but, you know, you got to think this through. I mean, do you – somebody – I mean, maybe if I was in my 20s still, that might have a little more appeal. But I really don't want to be in the position where I'm foraging for food. I don't want to have to go out and fight in the streets and, you know, battle – excuse me, battle for essential items. And – but that may happen, you know, and it may be a survival of the strongest. And but, you know, order is ironically when why authority is being ramped up everywhere. And we have more rules than ever and people are wearing masks and all that stuff. But there's really the rule. The general rule of law is broken down in many ways. And so it's very difficult to try to come up with you know, any kind of scenario where you can see a silver lining. I can't. I wish I could. Like I said, I've seen some hopium on the part of these parents and the school boards, but I don't know. That's you're going to have a lot move very fast. We did have in Loudoun County, Virginia here the most, I guess, the most obnoxious member of the school board to parents what did resign. I think it's pretty clear she was forced out, so it's nice to know that some pressure is building there. But, you know, there's every part of the establishment. You have the FBI that is going after parents and calling them potential domestic terrorists and saying we need to protect the school board. No, we need to protect the students from these school boards and these awful teachers. You know, I wrote Bullyocracy, and because, you know, part of that, I think that's why so many teachers don't like it. It's because it paints a pretty dim picture of teachers. Well, we're seeing – when you actually start seeing a lot of these teachers on their Instagram and when they're making their views, man, I mean, a lot of these people are completely deranged. And you wonder what's going on with their children. They're not the white people are problematic. Well, yeah, I think people in general are pretty problematic these days. But give me that essential item. Absolutely. Stock up on the catch of it. Yeah. I mean, you know, we're stocking up on toilet paper and stuff again. My wife's buying extra food. We have a bunch of wipe bashing going in. EndoFed said wipes are a hopeless bunch. Well, you know, that's why I, again, I talk so much about I hate the self-hating whites and everything. But, you know, I hate because of human emotion. But I have, you know, I read the bell curve years ago. I'm aware of the differences in IQ, but I don't care what the difference in IQ is. White people, at this point in time, generally speaking, are the dumbest race that has ever existed on the face of the earth because they're overseeing their own extinction. And they are too cucked out to stand up for their rights. They're scared of everything. And you can't do that. There's the only alpha males that apparently exist right now is are bullies, real bullies that are doing some horrible things. So it's a horrible time. And so despite, you know, I don't care what the IQ say, I'm sorry. You know, I think I worked many years as a blue collar worker. I work with lots of blacks, Hispanics, immigrants and everything. And working class whites that are kind of, you know, different kind of white, don't have any power. Those people are way smarter in general in terms of they're more open and they're street smart. And Chuck says he refused to be counted as white since he's Sicilian. Well, Chuck knows what I'm talking about. They're different kinds of intelligence. Like, you know, I'm all self-taught. I've read tons and tons of books. So I'm articulate. I can speak about all these subjects, but I would be a liability in terms of, you know, on a desert island or something. I couldn't build it. I can't do anything with my hands. All I can do is complain and tell people what you should be doing. And that's the way most people that have any intellect would be. In those situations, you would want the people that are good with their hands, you know, redneck types maybe, that they would be the most essential in that kind of situation. There's different types of intelligence. And so I think it's unfair, you know, to label people a particular way. But I'm just speaking in terms of just I've never seen any other. Can you imagine the Chinese, any Chinese getting together and having a bunch of Chinese people saying, you know, this is, we got to make China less Chinese, or we got to stop being so Chinese and hating themselves. I mean, no other race of people has ever done this. It's insane. And I don't understand it. And I'm going to keep talking about it. And it's not racist at all. I have white children. And one day I'll probably have white grandchildren. So I have a vested interest in that. I don't want them treated as second-class citizens any more than Martin Luther King's wanted his children to be treated as second-class citizens. You know, we need to get over this and stop looking at these little differences that the elite contrive for us, and start looking doing the thing they fear most, and that is joining hands together and looking at the common enemy, which is right in front of us. That elite, people that have created a situation where there's so much wealth in the United States that if you divide it up equally, every man, woman, and child could have $341,000 each. Just think of that. You got a couple kids, you're instant millionaires. Every family, every man a king, as Huey said. Now, I'm not suggesting we do that, but obviously, when you know there's that much money that you know of, and we don't know how many billions or even trillions might be hidden in those foundations and in the Federal Reserve, offshore, all the offshore profits at Apple and all these hideous globalist corporations have offshore and aren't taxed adequately. They're other kinds of tax shelters. Who knows how much money is really there? But when you have that kind of situation, you know something's desperately wrong, but you can't. You can't even get, you know, whenever I've talked about distribution of wealth, everybody I talk to, and I've never known anybody, I try to tell people, even if they're doing pretty well, I said, you know, there's under no form of redistribution of wealth would you have to give up anything. And you'd probably benefit. But everybody thinks that, especially if they have, if they're making $100,000 or something, you know, they think they're doing great, you know, they're doing well. But they think somehow, oh, you're after my money. Don't take my – no, no. Why would you think that? You really think you have enough money to do – how could you redistribute $100,000? Really? Come on. How many – but so this is the problem. And even people that are struggling will look at you and, oh, I guess you think your definition of rich is anybody that's got more than you. No, that's not my definition of rich. And I've written about it many times. But that's the problem, is you can't get people that would benefit from it to support it. Jay says it's going to be a slow fall. They're packing the country apart, picking the country apart as we speak. Absolutely. Although I think we're getting, you know, to the point where that frog is boiled. You know, so I think they've turned the heat up a lot. We can't jump out of the water anymore. Texas, I refuse. Sicilian was considered non-white by the U.S. government when my people got here, and Irish is still the lowest form. Well, there was a to keep the absolutely, yeah. I mean, I'm well aware of no Irish need apply was said about my people 150 years ago. Signs were everywhere, big potato eaters, and I can tell you, you know, my sister married an Italian, my much older sister married an Italian back in 1960, and I was only four at the time, but I knew in those early years when I was very young, I was aware that pretty much everybody in my extended family looked at that as something exotic. You know, like, she married an Italian. You know, I mean, I remember even at the time, something like spaghetti was considered so exotic for the average person. Whenever we would have it, it was a big thing, because it was always, we're having Italian spaghetti. It wasn't just spaghetti. It was Italian spaghetti. And so it was a different world. Things have obviously changed. But anyhow, so this is a little bit different show. Sorry we didn't get to take calls, and hopefully get the technical glitches lined up. But thanks so much. Hope you enjoyed the guest. Thanks so much for listening to the Donald Jeffrey Show. We'll see you next week. Thanks. Thank you.
Ocelli Effect calls in to the Ocelli Effect.
I just wanted to call in and tell you and Michael Swanson and J.P. Sicilian and all of the guests that you have how much I love your show. Always interesting. It's always informative. I just wanted to tell you in person on the phone. I mean, I love you. I love your show. I love everything you do. I will always be there to support you. You know that.
We appreciate you so much. You have okay. No idea.
Thanks. And most of our fans just send hate mail and death threats.
Ocelli.com.
Go ahead, caller.
Hey, I'm interested in the truth about the JFK assassination.
Right. Well, what do you want to know?
Judy Baker's wild claim, Oswald girlfriend, he knew Ruby and Barry, cancer weapons. Really?
I imagine I could claim I have four wheels. It doesn't make me a wagon, but okay.
Oswald was on the kill team and trying to prevent the murder of John Kennedy. Come on now. Has a real expert on the JFK assassination look into her claims?
Go to Amazon.com. Enter Judith Baker in her own words. You'll get results for a digital copy of a book where Walt Brown utilizes her own words and the known evidence in the case to get at, well, a different perspective, let's say. You can get Judith Barry Baker in her own words from the author himself, signed if you request it, by contacting Dr. Brown at KIASJFK@AOL.com. It's a fun book, and it actually dissects the many, many fantastic claims. Judith Barry Baker in her own words.
Thank you for all the great information.
Revelation through conversation.
In Denial, Secret Wars with Airstrikes and Tanks by Larry Hancock. Secret Wars became a staple of U.S. covert operations and are still happening today. Larry Hancock's book, In Denial, rips the cover off many of them. Using new files, it exposes things about the Bay of Pigs that no one has ever written about before. It shows why it really failed and why the United States did not learn from it. It also shows why other countries today are doing secret operations with more success. This is the book that puts what some want to deny into the light. In Denial, Secret Wars with Airstrikes and Tanks. Larry Hancock. For more information, go to Larry-Hancock.com. Pick up your copy of In Denial at Amazon.com in digital or physical form.
How do you move a mob? How do you excite? How do you make them feel as one with you?
Join them first.
Yes. When you speak to them as if you were a member of the mob. Speak to them in their language, on their level. Make their hate your hate. If they are poor, talk to them of poverty. If they are afraid, talk to them of their fears. If they are angry, give them objects for their anger. But
most of all,
for their anger,
that is most of the essence, is that you make this mob an extension of yourself.
I want extreme, and we will get the right people.